Good day and welcome to Westchester Talk Radio, westchestertalkradio.com. I'm John Marino and we are produced by Shark Creative, made possible by Robeson Oil, the house that service built by White Plains Hospital, by Hightower Westchester, managing your wealth to a fiduciary standard, and by Michael Labriola, landscape design and construction of Armonk. This is the Cup of Joe political show. I'm John Marino, and we are joined by Westchester County Executive George Latimer. George Latimer, been a few months since we last spoke. Much has happened since then. You've gotten another budget done. Here we are in 2024. And once again, you get a budget done in Westchester without raising property taxes, yet the price tag of the budget always seems to go up.
Well, John, first of all, good to be with you again, and I appreciate these opportunities to talk. The budget that we adopted at the end of 2023 that counts for the fiscal year calendar of 2024, you're correct, does not raise property taxes. We've kept it flat from the prior year budget to this one, and that's after four consecutive years of cutting county property taxes by a little bit each year. So you're paying less, we are taxing less property in the 2024 budget year than we did in the 2019 budget year. So that's 5 years difference of what's happened. The total budget is $2.4 billion, and it rises primarily because of ARPA money. ARPA money is revenue that comes in from the federal government and then goes out as targeted expenditures, but it raises the overall level of the budget. So it's not that we're spending more money in a profligate way. What we're doing is getting additional revenue that's targeted for certain purposes, and we've identified those purposes, whether it's food insecurity or the money that we're putting into affordable housing, which is the largest particular use of the ARPA money. And that's what's caused the ratchet up to the greater extent in costs. There are some inflationary costs that have affected our budget. So to do something today or yesterday for X costs X plus two today, and that's part of the increase as well.
Was there anything, what I would consider to be, what you might consider to be, like, really new that went into this budget that we didn't have before, but we're going to focus a bit more and a lot more on this now?
Well, I think we've had a number of new initiatives that represented areas that we had not worked in before. We had an initiative, for mental health crisis response teams that came out of our police reform discussions. And what that is now is mental health professionals that are available to respond with police to certain types of incidents. So if they're trained to be able to de-escalate, avoid a potential tragedy, when you know that the incident involves somebody who may be having a mental health episode, this budget expands that program and makes sure that it can satisfy in as many areas as possible. When you look at programs like that, whether it's the Black Maternal Healthcare Program, the program we have regarding our transportation buses to make the buses free in the summertime, as we've done the last 2 years, and then at the holiday seasons as well, all of those things cost a little more money year over year. So you have to recognize that without a brand new initiative, there is still a certain ratchet up in cost, but we're able to handle it within our existing revenues because we've had savings across the board. We've negotiated contracts. I've talked before about saving money on the prior Liberty Lines contract extension, $10 million over 5 years. What we saved in the Wheelabrator contract, $17 million over 10 years. Those types of things happen. And then one other thing, which I know you're aware of, is that we initiated a couple of different revenue streams that didn't exist before. We have a contract with a company called New Energen that helps us reduce our electric demand in times of peak usage, and therefore we save the utility having to buy on peak times electricity off the grid, which is very expensive, and they give us a financial rebate for that. So far, we've raised $1.5 million in additional revenue, not tax dollar revenue, but revenue that comes from another source to help us fuel our budget. We have a deal with Airbnb where they pay a payment in lieu of having to pay occupancy taxes. No other jurisdiction locally has come up with a plan like that, and that pays us $500,000 a year in round numbers of revenue that did not exist previously. So there are things like that that have happened that give us additional revenue, which allows us to have these programs and services in Westchester.
Now, I want to point out that also, too, with the work you've done as county executive and this new budget, the county has been able to get a top-notch credit rating, and I think that's something to speak about.
Well, when we first came into office in the beginning of 2018, we had a budget crisis on our hands. The 2018 budget, as it was adopted as an override of the veto from my predecessor, was not funded effectively. It did not handle money for union increases that had been negotiated for some of the unions. And there were some unions, you see, CSA notably, that was multiple years out, and we had to be able to make up that gap. In doing so in 2018, we did everything we could to pull ourselves out of the problems, but the rating agencies dropped us from a AAA bond rating to a AA plus, AA one. Now, that's a high rating. It's just not AAA. And that drop was a statement about the way the fiscal management occurred up to 2017. So we've now been diligent over the course of 5 years. We equalized sales tax revenue across the county. We did the things I've just talked about and more. And we were able to grow our reserves so that, like, you know, saving money in the bank account. If you have a normal life, you want to put money away in case of a rainy day. You want to put money away if you have children that have to be educated or retirement. We've been able to do that as well. We've been able to add to our reserve funds. That went very well with the Wall Street rating agencies. We show that we didn't use gimmicks. We didn't borrow money to pay for pension costs or to pay for certiorari reimbursements on tax reductions. And you can legally do that. But when you do that, you add interest to the principal payment of what you're borrowing. We avoided doing that now the last couple of years. And Wall Street looks at that and said, this is good fiscal policy. So Fitch has raised us back up to AAA. And the other two rating agencies, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, have put us at the highest rating below AAA and at a positive outlook. That's a long way from where we were when we started the game. And I have to say this, I'm not trying to be political, but I think most of the time people look at Democrats and they assume that Democrats will raise taxes. We didn't. Democrats will be fiscally irresponsible. We haven't been. And I might add that Democrats want to defund the police. We haven't. We've funded the police at the highest levels they've been funded. So I think sometimes the labels in the society misrepresent what the policies are. We've done good, positive, progressive things, but we've done it with fiscal responsibility. And I have to tell you, I've got a terrific team of people around me. I credit our budget director, Larry Sewell, our finance director, Karen Hablow, our key operating people, Joan McDonald, Emily Saltzman. And I'll credit also the fact that both Ken Jenkins and I have served in corporate America before we served in public office. People don't see that on the resume. They say, oh, you had this position, that position. I spent 20 years in corporate life. And while I was a sales and marketing executive, I understood how fiscal policy drives everything else. If you have the money to do things, you can do them. If you don't have the money to do things, you can have the best ideas in the world. So I think we have been both responsible fiscally and at the same time progressive in the things we've done. And it's so far worked well for us.
And you and the deputy county executive, Ken Jenkins, have always had a reputation of being people who reach across the aisle. You know how to work with everybody involved, all parties involved. And I think you should take a victory lap about the way you put this budget together, too, because this was done in a bipartisan fashion.
And let me credit the Board of Legislators on this, because I think Jewel Williams Johnson, who is the head of the Budget Appropriations Committee, Vedat Gashi, the chair of the board, and all the members of the board, Republican, conservative, Democrat, all engaged in the process. And in that process, there's a give and take. And unlike what you see at other levels of government, the federal government hasn't passed a full budget in years. They just have continuing resolutions so the government doesn't shut down. The state government has done a better job in recent memory. They've avoided the long, late budgets that were the case about 20 years ago, 25 years ago. But they still have a tough back and forth negotiations. We negotiated very amicably. I reached out to Jim Nolan and Margaret Kunzio, the minority leader on the minority side of the aisle. We talked to people all across the majority side of the aisle. And where there were ways that we could compromise to get to the budget, we did. And I think that's a model for what you need at other levels of government. You need sort of a rational way of talking to each other. You can have philosophical differences. You know, you can be a Met fan, you can be a Yankee fan, I can be a Met fan, and we can still have a beer together. And when we work cooperatively, we get a better result. And I think that's obvious from the way we've handled our business here in Westchester.
Now, the immigration problem, which has blanketed good part of the country, especially this part of the country, is this basically a New York City problem around this area, or is this something that Westchester, and I know you've been involved a couple of years now with the flights that came in, et cetera, helping out with that. Is this something that the county has gotten a lot more involved in and trying to alleviate too?
Well, it's a national problem, John, and the fundamental problem is there has been no willingness in Washington to come up with a new plan that modifies, changes, improves the way we handle immigration. The demand.
And what's the reason for that? Why do we get nowhere down in D.C.?
I think very simply, it's ideology. I think there's a group of people that do not want to have a different plan on the border, something that's that is wise and balanced. I think they want a big, beautiful wall, and they believe that you can wall out people, and that's it. Now, there's a big gap between open borders, everybody comes in, and dead closed borders, nobody comes in. There's a rational place to get to in the middle. And I know that some senators have been negotiating, and right now there's quite a debate in the Republican Party. I won't enter into the debate happening on the other side of the aisle, but there's a debate happening in the Senate and in the House in Washington over how much the Republicans can compromise to come up with a solution. It will take compromise. You need greater border security. I don't doubt that a second. I don't think you need a physical wall all along the border, but you need better border security. You also need to restructure the program for asylum seekers, because the way it's structured now, people can come in and claim the right for asylum, but it takes 3 years for their case to be adjudicated. They live in a hotel room, which is unacceptable. And the chances of them getting asylum, depending on which country they're coming from, is relatively small. You can justify it maybe if you're from Venezuela, but you can't justify it from other places. So you're setting up the system to fail. At the same time, we need to have a certain amount of that workforce, because you have in agriculture and a number of other industries a gap of Americans who are willing to work in certain types of jobs, which that immigrant population is prepared to do. And by the way, that's the history of America. I'm of Italian and Irish background. I gather you're of Italian-American background. That's why my great-grandfather, Donato Mineiro, came to the United States, because they needed stonemasons. And he was a young man, and he came into Westchester back in the 1880s or 90s. I'm not sure exactly when. And he put his stone skills to work in a country that needed that work done, where he couldn't find that work in Benevento, Italy. So this type of movement has got a historical basis to it. But we need to have a rational, bipartisan plan. It appears that under the current politics of Washington, we're not getting that. So your question is it a New York problem? Is it a Westchester problem? Well, by extension, it is, because what happens are the people come over the border. They're in southern Texas. The Texas governor decides he's going to send them to New York, Chicago, Philadelphia. He's making a political point. He doesn't send them to Chattanooga, Tennessee. He doesn't send them to Omaha, Nebraska. He doesn't send them to states where his party has responsibility for the government. He sends them to states that have Democrats in charge, and it destabilizes the problems here. New York City has done its very best to handle the humanitarian crisis thrown at its doorstep. Westchester, unique amongst the suburban counties, has worked to help resolve it, insofar as we've had three placements, the defined placements of migrants. Migrants come individually. We have three placements. We've managed that process with the city of Yonkers, the city of White Plains, and the village of Ardsley. There's been no crime here in Westchester amongst that community. There's been no disease spread. But the anger comes from those people who don't want to see anybody come over the border, and they react based on that ideology. We have the same problem with the airport issue that you sort of alluded to. A number of summers ago, plane flights were coming in, dropping off migrants, putting them on buses who were being sent to other places. But the politics of the moment rose up and said, we have to stop these planes from coming in. Can't do it, dude. It's federal policy that makes those planes land here, not county policy. And it was an effort to politicize it. And as long as one side of the aisle wants to just politicize it for votes, you will not get to the rational solution in the middle that you need. You need stronger border security. No question in my mind. There's some people that don't view that as important. I view that as important. But you also have to have reform in the process. And there has to be a path to work. And if you don't accept that, then you're not going to have the compromise you need. And people will still try to escape their poverty and their suppression in other parts of the world and come to America, because we are that hope that people have, the same hope that Donato Mineiro and I guess John James Latimer, I never met these men, I descend from them, but this is the hope that they had when they saw America as a bright, shining light. And I might add that the Italians and the Irish were not particularly welcomed when they came here. The Jewish folks who came here at the turn of the prior century were not welcomed here. The Asians who came in through San Francisco were not particularly welcomed here. So this is nothing new. We're watching this, just the same thing happen amongst another generation of people.
COVID and respiratory illnesses made a bit of a comeback this winter, and we seem to have a handle on it. Has the county totally rebounded from the pandemic?
Totally is hard to say, because there are certain societal changes that we've made in light of COVID that I don't think will ever go back. The most obvious example is working in an office setting. There are a number of companies and businesses now that accept the fact that a significant portion of their workforce wants to and can work from home 1 or 2 days a week. I don't think anybody has got a completely remote office function that really works well. But with that thought in mind, you go to any commuter rail station on a Monday morning and certainly on a Friday morning, and you do not see the people queuing up to go into the city as they did before. And that changes our office space demand. We have a real weakness in commercial office space, not just in Westchester, but all over. That's changed. That expectation of working from home is convenient in some ways, but it also creates some other problems. You can't team build. I've been involved in corporate settings, and in this government, which is a corporation, although a government corporation, you can't build team. You can't have mentoring between more senior people and less senior people if people aren't physically in the same space learning and growing from each other. So to that extent, COVID impacts are still with us. I think it still impacts our education structure. Kids who are in ninth grade now, who are in fifth grade or sixth grade during the heart of the COVID thing, have catching up to do in their educational sphere. So that's still there. In terms of the heart of the pandemic, we're well past the horrible spring of 2020, in which we had 70 people die one night and 30 people die the next night, and we had to go out and rent a refrigerator truck, probably the most horrific moment of my county executive career. To have to just warehouse people who had died, and just horrific. But we're past that. The vaccination program, to the greater extent, has worked. People do contract COVID, but I'm sure you see this in your world. I certainly see it in my world. You hear that somebody has COVID, they're home for a couple of days, they come back, they're fine. They haven't infected everybody around them. It's not like one person gets it and 30 people are all out with COVID. So I think to the greater extent we've rebounded. The strength and the suppleness of Westchester's economic base has bounced back. That's got very little to do with my governmental policies. Let's just be honest. Credit it for what it is. You have major U.S. corporations here. You have growth organizations that are smaller but thriving. And in this environment, I think we've seen Westchester come back faster than many of our surrounding counties. And admittedly, we're different from the city, but I think we bounced back as fast or faster than the city has. And it's gratifying. It's gratifying to see that we're getting closer to normal. You know, we're playing basketball back in the county center again. That's close right to normal. We do, in fact, have in-person events for community groups. I went to a couple yesterday. They're in, you know, in the same room without masks on. So we're bouncing back. But it's not totally back, and I don't know that it ever will be. It's changed certain things forever.
County Executive George Latimer here on Westchester Talk Radio, westchestertalkradio.com. Cup of Joe political show. I'm John Marino. George Latimer, you are running for Congress, the 16th Congressional District covering Southern Westchester and a portion of the North Bronx, and you'll be in the Democratic primary. The first question that I think anybody would ask is, we already have a Democrat who represents that district. Why do you need to run?
You know, party affiliation is not the beginning and the end of an evaluation. You have to look at what it is that you want to see your representative in Washington, D.C. do. What do you want them to espouse, not only what their party affiliation is? I'm running in this race because I believe that voters need a choice. And I've been told by many, many people from a wide variety of circles that they wanted a choice in this year's opportunity to see who they thought could best represent them. I have already served as a legislator in four different legislative settings, the city council and the community I live in, a member of the Westchester County Board of Legislators. You and I remember that from other days when we would interview when I was chairman of the board over 25 years ago, then my tenure in Albany as both a state assemblyman as a state senator. As a legislator, I've proven I understand how to pass legislation, how to work and pass legislation, how to extract out of the executive branch resources that help your district. And of course, now that I've been an executive for these 6 years, I have a better idea of how you have to do it. And that I also show a universality in my approach to representation. I clearly am part of certain demographic groups. By my religion, I'm Christian. By my gender, I'm male. My age and my being of European extraction, all of those things put me somewhere on the demographic line. But I've always looked at trying to work for every single group. When we go down to Mount Vernon and we fix Memorial Field, which was a mess.
Yeah, I went by it the other day. It was incredible. I had a passenger in my car, and I said, great. I remember when I almost broke my ankle here in 1989.
Well, it looks great. And the beneficiaries of that field are primarily the young kids of Mount Vernon, who are primarily African-American kids. That's the neighborhood I grew up in, not that part of the South Side, the other part. but African-American kids are going to enjoy that field in higher proportion. When we fix the Sprain Ridge pools on Jackson Avenue, they were closed 7 years, 8 years. We opened it up. The kids jumping in those pools, they're not the country club kids. The country club kids have their pool.
Right.
These are the kids of Yonkers and Greenberg that are going to go and have a public access to pools. So I've never governed in the concept that whatever I represent as a demographic is all that there is. And I think that's what we need to have more of a focus on in our representation in Washington. We have urban needs. And we have suburban needs. We have needs of people who care deeply about climate change and the environment. For them, that's the lead issue. Social justice is the lead issue for somebody else. And you have to address all of those issues. And I believe if I go to Washington as a congressman for Westchester, I know Westchester intimately. And by the way, I know the North Bronx pretty well. I went to college in the Bronx. My first full-time job was in the Bronx, and my first girlfriend was in the Bronx. Didn't work out, but it enabled me to go up and down Baychester Avenue, up and down the Boston Post Road, 241st Street, 233rd, Neary, 233rd, all the parts of Wakefield that's in this district, White Plains Road, 222nd, 225th. I've been up and down these streets in my life, so I'm not a stranger to the Bronx portion of the district, and certainly not to the Westchester portion of the district. And I think what I offer as a choice is a person who will be fully engaged in being a legislator. And I'm not looking to get on national television. I'm not looking to be a spokesperson for a point of view. I'm looking to be part of a mainstream Democratic group, hopefully the majority, that can accomplish things. I'm not looking to make a statement by being part of a splinter group. And so that's a choice. And if you are a Democrat, and if you live in whatever these district lines now end up, you'll have that choice. You can vote for the incumbent. You can vote for me. If I lose the primary, that's it. I'm out of the race and that's done. And the choice has been made. But at least you have a choice. That's what a democracy is. You know, and I'm watching, you know, some of the politics, the attack ads and people going after me now and all this stuff. All of that stuff is just sideshow. What matters to you is the basis upon which you make the decision. Do you like the direction we're going in? You vote for the incumbent. If you think there's a change and I offer that change, then you vote for me.
You talked about the district lines. That will work together with the actual primary day. Where are we now with that?
Well, anybody's guess. As we're having this conversation in the first week of February, we do not know yet what the lines are. We may know sometime in the month of March. I doubt we would know any sooner. We would see some proposed lines from the Independent Redistricting Commission, but they'd still have to go through the scrutiny of the state legislature. And then the final lines in either case are subject to litigation. You know, I'm not a lawyer, you're not a lawyer, but there are a lot of lawyers out there, and they would know exactly how to file a case in state court, federal court, whatever they want to do. It is conceivable that just the litigation that follows the decision-making process could forestall the final adoption of lines into April, maybe May. And the later it goes, the more likely the June primary won't hold, and they'll do what they did 2 years ago, which is move the primary to August, most likely. It could be July as well. But that kind of a decision, I don't know. And I also don't know what in the lines will be in the district or not in the district. We know that a bulk of Westchester communities in Southern Westchester will be in it. But what the final cut is, we don't know. And it's, John, you know, John, I'm running a race where I don't exactly know the course route, and I don't exactly know where the finish line is. And that's a heck of a tough race to be in. Because I have knowledge of Westchester County in its entirety, I have a governmental reason to be everywhere in Westchester County. I'm just doing my job as county executive. And then when I am talking about federal issues, I'm trying to make common sense. And if you wind up in the district when this thing is done, then you get to choose, you know. And of course, the Bronx section as well is fluid. And we'll see what happens. We'll know at some point in time. Conceivably, we could know in time for June 25th primary. And on the other extreme, if litigation becomes extended, particularly if it gets to the federal court, you may not have a decision, and the lines might stay the same for the 24th cycle. That's possible. So who knows?
This will not be the Democratic primary. Will not be on the same day as the presidential primary in the
Correct.
State.
Yes. Presidential primary is April 2nd. At this stage of the game, I don't know. There'll be competitors in both parties, but I think we all pretty much understand that Donald Trump and the Republican Party and Joe Biden and the Democratic Party are the likely nominees. And that to that extent, there'll be a primary on April 2nd. The June 25th primary is set for any other positions. We have, I think, in the Democratic Party, a primary for district attorney. That is very likely to come up. There's still petitioning that has to happen in order to qualify candidates. But we expect there to be a Democratic primary for district attorney. There may be a Democratic primary for county court judge on June 25th. And then, of course, maybe the congressional primary and then any other legislative primaries that form between now and then. We won't know until petitions are submitted sometime at the end of March as to who has or has not qualified, and all of that is yet ahead of us. And as I've said, then, you know, there's always the potential for the third primary, which would be a delayed congressional primary.
Final 5 or 6 minutes with County Executive George Latimer, candidate for the Democratic nomination in the 16th Congressional District. Jamal Bowman is the incumbent. He served a couple of terms already, the district covering southern Westchester and most northern portion of the Bronx. Couple more, we touched on immigration, couple more national issues that you would have to deal with if you go to Congress. The state of the economy. And we have different economists on all sides who tell us different things every day.
Well, first of all, the economic policy is established primarily by the president and the executive administration, the Federal Reserve Bank system, U.S. Office of the Treasury, Secretary of the Treasury, have the greatest policy impact on fiscal policy. But I've learned a long time ago that what public officials do that relate to the economy are an input, but they are not always the decisive input. It's not just merely the money flow that you create or the level of interest that you charge that makes the difference. We as individual consumers have some degree of consumer confidence based on lots of different factors. And if we think that we've got a stable employment stream and we're going to have money in our pocket, we make certain economic decisions. If we're unsure of that, if it's a time of layoffs and a recession for businesses, then we make other types of decisions that slow the economy down. Inflation meant that the economy was moving ahead much faster than we liked, and things were increasing in prices. What I've seen most recently is a decrease in those things. I go to the pump, and I gassed up at 3.19 at a gas station in North White Plains, where at that gas station, I was probably paying about $3.90 or $4 a gallon a month or two, a year or two ago. Now, you know, when things get bad, when Wall Street has a bad day, people who are critical of the economy immediately rush out and say, look how bad this is. This is terrible. Nobody says the same thing when the prices start to come down. Food prices have dropped a bit in a number of areas. Certain products are still high priced. I don't do the grocery shopping, but I do go in the grocery store for certain types of things. And when I look at the prices, what's a box of cereal cost now? Is it $5.49? Is it $6.29? Is it $5.19? That gives me some indicator of what's happening in the economy. I think the economy is getting better. However, I have to tell you that I've also learned this, and I think I've evidenced it in this job, and these interviews are part of it. You must communicate constantly with people. As a county executive, people don't really know or care that much about what happens at a county government. Let's just be honest with ourselves. But I am doing the weekly 2 o'clock updates. I'm happy to be available to you and other members of the media to talk about these things. There is a need to better communicate to the American public what is happening in the economy. It is complicated. And most people only see it through the prism of their own pocketbook. But right. By all indicators, the economy has been getting better, and we went through a terrible pandemic that affected everything. We had a chain, a supply chain issue that followed the pandemic. You notice we're not talking about that anymore, right? Everybody's saying, oh, supply chain. We're not talking about that anymore. That's progress. But somebody has got to remind you of that, because absent that, if you go to the grocery store and you pay 20 cents more for a box of cereal, well, all things go into hell in a handbasket. And I think it's important to understand that. Now, as a member of Congress, I would hope to be able to vote for intelligent spending that would represent a positive impact on the economy. I would certainly have voted for the infrastructure bill when it came up. It did pass, but it didn't pass with unanimity. There were people who voted no on the infrastructure bill. I think that was a wrongheaded vote. Infrastructure improves long-term physical things in the society, and it has a long-term fiscal impact, because you're able to fix the bridge, fix the road, it stays for 20 years. And when you have that kind of an improvement, it represents the society moving forward, as well as the jobs of the people who worked on the fixing of the bridge. So I think that's been a real successful policy by the federal government. But I do think that, you know, the narrative has not followed the actual results. And that's why people see and feel that things aren't going well, when in fact they're getting better from where they were at the worst.
Now, some people might say, well, George Latimer, he knows everything about local and state government because you work with people all around New York State. You know how everything works in the Empire State from the governor on down. What does he know about foreign policy? What are his thoughts on foreign policy? You talked about a moment ago the supply chain, and that seems to be back to normal. We have obviously a situation in the Middle East with the Houthis in the Red Sea, et cetera, where that supply chain could be affected. And some say we are walking ourselves into World War III slowly, step by step, especially by responding to the Iranians the way we have the past few days. What would you say to someone who said that to you?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, when I was a Rye City councilman running for the county legislature, someone said, what does he know about county government? How will he perform in county government? He's only been a councilman. When I was a long-term county legislator and ran for the state assembly, people who didn't favor my candidacy said, we don't know anything about the state. Westchester isn't like the whole state. So after 13 years of being in the state legislature, when I ran for county executive, they said, but he's never been an executive. How can he be an executive? So the bottom line is the skills that you have are the ones that you can put on display in a moment's notice. Whether or not all of your skills are easily discernible to other people, you know what you have and what you can do. Now, I have not served in the federal government to this point. So someone might ask, what does he know about foreign policy? Here's what I think about your question in general. We are in a continual battle between the forces of democracy and the forces of tyranny. And this has been going on over a long period of time, but for our purposes, since the end of the Second World War. Since the end of the Second World War, you had the rise of the communist bloc, wasn't always together, but Russia, China, ultimately North Korea, and a number of other countries have been on the side of tyranny. And America, Western Europe, Japan, in the post-World War era, were on the side of freedom and democracy. Imperfect. None of our democracies are perfect. We all have flaws and things that make us not live up perfectly to the standards that we set for ourselves. But as I said to somebody once, if you are gay, are you better off in Tel Aviv or Tehran if you're gay? And what that tells you is that even an imperfect democracy is a better choice than living under tyranny, when tyranny will impose a certain way of life upon you, and you have no choice at that point. We are facing multiple threats in this world from multiple sources. I think Russia and Vladimir Putin represents a threat with what he's doing in Ukraine. And don't think for a second, if we get out of Ukraine, that it's going to stop Putin from moving into the Baltic states and conceivably into Scandinavia with his influence. Iran is playing puppeteer with Hezbollah in Lebanon, with the Houthis in Yemen. And these are states that have the worst possible human rights circumstances. So when people tell me, well, you know, I think Israel, you know, they're really not that great a place for these reasons, not as democratic as it should be. Do you honestly believe that the alternative, which is Iran controlling the Middle East, would be a better thing? They would create a bigger base for terrorism that would then strike in Western Europe and ultimately in North America. And you cannot keep these issues at bay. As we saw in 9/11, they can fly across the world and do damage to us. We have to stand behind democracies wherever we can. And if we can do that without going to World War III, that's the best strategy. But if we back down, if we take the attitude that, well, we can negotiate with these people. If somebody wants to kill you, they are negotiating with you now to create a climate by which they can kill you later. And it's been proven in history. Go back to the 1930s. How many times was there appeasement of Hitler? Did it ever appease him when he got the Sudetenland, when he Anschlussed Austria? Did that appease him? Did the Japanese militarists who picked up islands across the Pacific, were they satisfied with what they picked up, or did they keep going? This is the mindset of a tyrant. So America's foreign policy has to be intelligent, but it also has to be robust. And if we send a message that we will abandon Ukraine, or we'll abandon what's happening in Israel, and I understand Israel is a problematic player in certain ways, but if we abandon Israel, if we abandon Ukraine, do you think that Kim Jong-un sitting in Pyongyang isn't going to see that? That he wants a unified Korea, which means a South Korea under the control of North Korea, because of the economy of South Korea would revitalize North Korea, which is a basket case of an economy. That's what this county executive knows about foreign policy. So it's not a militaristic policy. It's understanding that diplomacy, economic assistance helps and is an important tool. But at some point in time, behind that has got to be strength. And you know where I learned that from? the streets of growing up on the south side of Mount Vernon. When a kid pushed me over and pushed me down, he was going to keep doing it until I stood up to him. Even if he socked me in the nose, he realized at the end of the day I would stand up for myself. And he'd find some other kid to push around. And that is a harsh reality of the world. And my friends who feel very sympathetically, as do I, about the tragedies of the world, have to realize that there are people in this world under tyranny that have no care about human life. They kill their own people, much less kill other people. So that's the international policies we have to pursue. Given that, America is fundamentally a good country, fundamentally a country that wants to see things happen positively. If we in America slide into irrelevance, the whole world goes into a dark night. The whole world goes into a dark night.
And I have to add to you what you learned on the streets of Mount Vernon, I learned on the streets of East Harlem, too. You hit a bully back. You got to go back at him. May not be your nature what you really want to do, but you have to do it to help yourself and to make sure that that bully doesn't try what he's doing to you with anybody else. If you are elected to Congress, what is the line of succession for a county executive here in Westchester?
Well, the provisions are that the deputy county executive, in this case, Ken Jenkins, would become acting county executive for 90 days. So if I were to be elected in November of this year, I would resign my seat as county executive in January to take my seat in Congress. Ken would become the county executive sometime around the 2nd or 3rd of January, and his term would take him, that interim term would take him into April. The Board of Legislators would meet to set a date for a special election for the unexpired term, which would be 1 year, the year of 2025. The election of 2025 would happen. A special election does not have a primary component to it. So the four existing major parties, Democrat, Republican, Conservative, and Working Families, would nominate candidates. Those candidates would run in a special election. The special election most likely would be set for sometime in March, so that that person would then take over the responsibilities at the end of the interim period of the DCE's responsibility, and then would take through the end of next December or this December to complete that that term. And actually, 25 would be the end of next December. So with that thought in mind, then there's a normal election in 25. We have another issue, which we don't have time to talk about, which is the state's policies to change odd-numbered years to even-numbered years. That throws in a further complication. But the bottom line is that it would be the deputy county executive for 90 days, a special election for the balance of the year, and then the normal election process, the November of 25.
George Latimer, I want to congratulate you on another budget without property tax increases and also getting that credit rating for the county all the way back up there again. Good luck in your race for Congress. We'll talk again. And what can we say except keep doing what you're doing, right, George?
Thank you, John, and thank you for your hard work behind the microphone. It's always been appreciated all these years.
Thank you. We go back almost 40 years together now. It's been a lot of fun. I hope we get to do another 40 more.
I hope so, John. Thank you.
George Latimer, County Executive, Westchester Talk Radio, westchesterTalkRadio.com. I'm John Marino. This is the Cup of Joe political show. We are produced by Shark Creative, made possible by Robeson Oil, the house that service built, Hightower, Westchester, managing your wealth to a fiduciary standard, by White Plains Hospital, and by Michael Abriola Landscape Design and Construction of Armonk. Catch all of our Westchester, Rockland, Putnam, Dutchess, Orange, and Fairfield County Talk Radio programming on our YouTube channel, and also, too, it's called Shark Creative YouTube. Download our app, Westchester Talk. Take it with you anywhere and everywhere you go. And yes, we are now on Apple Podcasts, too. Thank you, George.
John, thank you very much. Always
all right,
a pleasure.
I'll see you next time around.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.